Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Listeners do support this program, and I want to name names. Hopefully it won't get you on the no-fly list. Margaret Anderson, James Balk, James Swift, Christopher Welsh, David Polson, and Lee Ann Rader. They are voluntary subscribers to the Peter B. Collins Show. Our voluntary subscriptions start as low as $5 a month. Just look for the tab on my website where it says you can help at peterbcollins.com. In the second portion of this podcast, we're going to meet a retired California Superior Court judge, Richard Tuttle, who spent almost $40,000 of his own money to take out full-page newspaper ads decrying the work of Justice Anthony Kennedy. He says he's responsible for the two worst Supreme Court decisions in Judge Tuttle's lifetime, which he says are the Citizens United case and Bush v. Gore. And one of the major papers in California refused to take his money to publish his ad. So we're going to dig into that with Judge Richard Tuttle a little bit later in today's podcast program. But first, as you know, there are many people, both Republicans and Democrats, who seem to be itching for a fight with Iran.
Bomb, 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 Iran. Bomb, 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 Iran. Bomb, 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 Iran.
I mean, remember in the 08 campaign when a froggy-voiced John McCain tried to sing this at a campaign stop? Well, that urge continues, and in some quarters, people believe that it is part of Israel's foreign policy that seems to be picked up by the United States, at least in some quarters. And there's a recent case that is fascinating and head-scratching all at the same time. And that has to do with the recent repatriation of an Iranian nuclear scientist named Shahram Amiri. And joining us today to talk about it is a man who knows a lot more than I do, Philip Giraldi, a former CIA counterterrorism official. He writes for antiwar.com and the American Conservative. He's been on our program before because of his excellent coverage of Sibel Edmonds' case. And Phil, I welcome you back to the show today.
Thank you, Peter.
Good to talk with you. Give us a thumbnail sketch. Who was Shahram Amiri before he came to the attention of American intelligence officials?
Well, Amiri was is a scientist. He worked in what is broadly described as the Iranian nuclear industry, in that he worked on radiology with medical applications, and in some other related areas. He was not involved in the generation of nuclear energy or in the possible Iranian nuclear weapons program. He apparently, as my sources are telling me, volunteered several years ago to work for the CIA. This was possibly done over the internet, which is kind of a scary thought.
A walk-in by email?
Yeah, walk-in by email. though another source suggested, actually, he did walk into the U.S. Consulate General in Istanbul. But in any event, he made contact with the United States. The United States intelligence officers who were assessing his case obviously were very interested in him because it's, of course, rather difficult to get people who are anywhere near the Iranian nuclear program, and he was acquired as a source, did not provide much information of any kind, but after a couple of years decided to defect to the United States.
Okay. And are we clear that there is no doubt as to the nature that he approached the U.S. and that they did not identify him and attempt to flip him?
Well, you know, this is always the question. I mean, it's let's face it. I mean, there are a couple of classic descriptions of the intelligence world. One of them you've probably heard is the wilderness of mirrors, and the other one is smoke and mirrors, which is the title of my column at antiwar.com.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's deception on top of deception on top of deception in intelligence operations. I would not want to go so far as to say this guy could not conceivably have been someone who was working either for both sides or for one side against the other or for a combination of you know, various combinations of possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that all the indications were that this guy was legitimate. When he defected, if he had been a double for the Iranians, he would have been prepared with some stories that would have led his CIA interrogators down paths that were, you know, impossible to follow.
He would have brought some bite-sized cheese.
Yeah, he would have brought some stuff with him. And in fact, as it turned out, the assessment I've heard was that basically he didn't really have anything of note except for one thing. Obviously, when scientists, just like academics or anybody else, they get together, they talk. And this guy had a pretty good feel from talking to other scientists, other people he'd gone to school with, and that sort of thing, that there is no Iranian nuclear weapons program. And this kind of, since it's something that, you know, we refer to as scuttlebutt, it kind of became something that in the process of preparing a current assessment of Iran, it might have contributed to one small footnote.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you had said that your sources indicate that this man, Amiri, A-M-I-R-I, was a nuclear scientist, but not involved with either the nuclear power plant development in Iran, which has been underway since the 1970s when we tried to sell them nuclear reactors for generating electricity, and that he's not involved in any weapons program. So the only other areas I know that nuclear items are used is in medical and research. So do we have any further details on what exactly his specialty is?
Yeah, that I don't know. I mean, but clearly that you're quite right. That is the area that he would have been involved with. He was involved in particularly in radiology used in medicine and also use of radiology in experimental ways. In research, so that clearly is where he came from, and you can imagine if you're looking for a nuclear scientist who's developing cutting edge technologies that relate to weapons, he's not exactly your guy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I will certainly come back to what you said that the information he provided is that there is no substantive Iranian nuclear program. That's clearly the core of what I want to focus on. But as we look at the process, when did he first surface in Istanbul or through this email? How long was he in a protective bubble of the U.S. Intelligence Committee? And then we'll talk a little bit about his decision to return to Iran.
Yeah, well, that's, of course, an important question. The United States is hinting that he has been a what they would refer to as an asset for a long time, meaning maybe 5 years. But the timeline doesn't seem to work with that, and it seems that it more likely is maybe 2 or 3 years that he was cooperating. And, you know, the thing is that the timeline is important in a propaganda sense, because if the United States is able to make the point and convince the Iranians that this guy had been working for the U.S. for 5 years, that will make the Iranians very nervous about their own security. So this is kind of a game being played. And whether he was in fact cooperating for a long time or a short period of time will pretty much condition how the Iranians react to him. And I would suspect in this case the United States is trying to burn this guy because he returned home. And so they're trying to make him look as if he's a much bigger player than he actually was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was struck because I'd never heard of this guy, And then I saw a clip from a news conference, and State Department spokesman P.J. Crowley, who I know a little bit, he was at the Center for American Progress in between administrations, and was a pretty strong critic of the war in Iraq and some of the issues related to that. But he offered a curious statement. I can only paraphrase it. But he basically was trying to inoculate the U.S. media and public to expect bullshit coming from this guy as he returned to Tehran. And it seemed very interesting that they were doing this in advance of any claim that he might have made. And subsequently, he appears to have made claims that he was tortured and that he was a victim here, that he was captured by U.S. intelligence. So we have a number of conflicting stories that have surfaced regarding Amiri, and that, of course, is like the forest of mirrors you described.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. There, you know, each side is trying to gain whatever advantage it can from this situation, and there are a couple of subplots for the United States. I mean, the United States, first of all, wants to make it look like this was a great intelligence coup. Why would they do that? Well, they would do that because that makes CIA look good, that makes the administration look good, that makes everybody look good. Even if this guy was not producing anything that really was significant at all. And so that's one of the subplots. Now, the Iranians on their side, there was a statement today that the Iranian press service Fars released, saying that this guy actually had been a double the whole time. So here's the Iranian subplot, which the Iranians are trying to say, ha ha, we fooled you.
Yeah.
We ran a guy against you. You didn't know it. And he was really our man. So the fact is the guy was not their man. And it seems evident to me anyway that if he had been their man, he would have been working a lot more at being their man.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't. So I would say he was not. But it's the Iranians attempting to get what they can out of this case.
Just a quick sidebar. Were you a fan of Mad Magazine and the Spy versus Spy comic panels?
Oh, absolutely.
Don Martin, I think, was the artist on
that?
Yeah,
that's right. Don Martin. Yep.
I love those. They're Cold War relics, but yep. I hope they're preserved online somewhere.
That would be nice.
Phil, let me quote from the closing paragraph of an article that you will publish at antiwar.com. I've spoken to a number of intelligence officers who claim to have some insights into what happened with Shahram Amiri. My sources all agree that Amiri was not kidnapped. If he had been, he would have disappeared down some hole after being encouraged to tell everything he knows. He was a volunteer, meaning he contacted CIA himself. One account being that it was done over the internet, and another suggesting that he walked into the consulate in Istanbul, as you mentioned. Either way, he volunteered his services. He cooperated with the U.S. for a while, and there's nothing in what he provided that would suggest that he was a double agent. He did not have information of any real value apart from his second-hand corroboration of the lack of any Iranian nuclear weapons program, which might merit a footnote in the next Iranian National Intelligence Estimate, if it ever surfaces. Now, this is an important point because he did emerge and come into contact with our intelligence officials in between the release of the last national intelligence estimate, and we're still waiting for the next one vis-a-vis Iran. And it's important to note that there was a big gap between 2002 and, I believe, 2007 when the most recent one was released. Is 07 correct?
Yeah, December 07, that's
yeah.
Right.
And the one in 07, which had to be pried out of Dick Cheney's clasping fingers because the White House was really trying to block release of it, but it said that in recent years, and it, I believe, went back to 05, that there was no ongoing effort by Iran to build a nuclear weapon. And this, you know, I opened with that song about bombing Iran because at that time, Phil, I remember there were clear and detailed rumors, particularly about Cheney, that we did have plans to attack Iran and we were essentially looking for a provocation. And this NIE, when it came out, deflated those possibilities in the final year of the Bush administration.
Yeah, that's correct. The NIE basically eliminated any possibility in the last year of the Bush administration that there would be an attack on Iran, and that for that I am eternally grateful. And it basically said that Iran had abandoned a nuclear weapons program as early as 2003 and had not reinstated it. And so that basically took the argument out from, cut the argument out from under the feet of the neocons to say that, you know, there was an imminent threat from Iran. Now, what the neocons have done is they've kind of shifted their argument. The argument is now that Iran should not even have the capability to enrich uranium mm-hmm. as fuel for electricity generation or anything else, because once you have that capability, you have the capability of going on to the next step. Now, this basically shifts the argument completely away from weapons, just to say that we don't want people to have the capability, or people that we disapprove of to have the capability.
Right.
Because certainly there are 100 other countries in the world that already have that capability.
And this is where it becomes, where U.S. policy becomes solidly aligned with Israeli policy. And this is where I have real concerns, because in no manner do I hope that Iran ever acquires a nuclear weapon. I don't want to see any new nations develop nuclear weapons capability. That said, I don't believe that even if Iran had an arsenal of nuclear weapons today, that that represents a direct threat to the interests of the United States of America. It does reflect a serious regional threat, and that, of course, is Israel's business and, in my view, not ours. But we have this deep alignment of U.S. and Israeli foreign policies, and the influence that AIPAC wields over Democrats and Republicans alike, Bush and Obama alike. And so it's very hard to parse, Phil, where our interests end and to what extent we're carrying water, maybe even heavy water, for the Israelis.
Well, I think we are indeed carrying water for the Israelis in this case, because the, as you point out, Iran, even with a couple of primitive nuclear weapons, does not pose a threat to the United States. And it really doesn't even pose a threat to Israel. The point is that this is a, what this is really about is that Israel currently has the monopoly on nuclear weapons in that part of the world.
Yeah.
And Israel does not want to give up that monopoly. There is no reason to assume that Iran, possessing, as I say, a couple of simple nuclear weapons that would be heavy and hard to deliver anywhere, would necessarily threaten Israel or any of its neighbors. But the fact is, this is really a question about a monopoly of power.
Mm-hmm. And I want to underscore that I don't consider myself stupid or lulled into any sense of complacency about the long-term interests of Iran. I believe the mullahs and the supreme leader there do want to join the nuclear club. I think they want to raise their stature to one that they see as equal to Israel in their region. And so I do believe they have the aspiration. But to be making war plans and to be putting sanctions on a country for this aspiration seems self-defeating to me, and a poor focus of foreign policy. And yet at the same time, the discovery of this underground weapons facility at Qom, Q-O-M, the holy city north of Tehran, was a little unsettling. And because of this ongoing barrage of information, maybe propaganda, about the Iranian threat, I have to say that there's a part of me that is highly suspicious, and that wants to dismiss Amiri's information that there is no current weapons program. And Phil, that's offset by so much disinformation that we received about the intentions of Saddam Hussein and about the status of nuclear or other weapons of mass destruction going back to 2002 and 2003. And let me just tell you a quick story. About a year and a half ago, I had a chance to interview Dan Rather. And I referenced to Dan Rather his final interview with Saddam Hussein, where he asked him, point blank, do you have a nuclear weapon? And Saddam, more or less point blank, he never answered things very directly, but he said no. And I asked Dan Rather, well, did you believe him? Because it appears he was telling the truth. And Rather had a bizarre answer. He said, that's not my place, whether to believe him or not. I said, okay, but as a person, after the fact here, you know, do you believe him now? Did you believe him then? And he did not want to answer that question. And so I understand how people wrestle with these things, but I feel that we've been lied to before, and I see an agenda to lie to us about this. And so it becomes a kind of a tug of war, at least mentally, trying to figure out, okay, who should I believe, who should I trust in this exchange?
Well, I the simple answer to that is probably the best source of information is the United Nations, which has inspectors inside Iran and has had inspectors inside Iran for many years. And the consensus from the United Nations is that Iran has basically been telling the truth about its program, although it's concealed certain things and fibbed about certain other things and stretched the truth on occasion. It doesn't seem to have any kind of major facility to develop anything that could equate to a weapon. But as an intelligence officer, I would say if I were in Iran's position, threatened almost every 2 or 3 days, either by the United States or by Israel, I would very definitely be thinking of developing a nuclear weapon. And I think where Iran comes down is Iran basically wants to have the capability to ramp up to develop a nuclear weapon in a short period of time if they felt that that became necessary. I think that's kind of where they are right now.
And isn't there also a desire for ambiguity where they want people who are inclined to think that Iran has a nuclear weapon to think that?
Yeah, there certainly would be the question of, you know, having that as a deterrent, yeah, that the Iranians would not want to be completely, shall we say, transparent on the issue. I mean, publicly, they're very transparent on the issue. They say they don't have one. They don't intend to create one. But the fact is, nevertheless, the world knows that they have the technology and that they have a program that in a sense, could be developed into something more threatening.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think your point about the inspectors is instructive, because when I go back to the period of 2002 and early 2003, the voice that I believed and continue to respect is Scott Ritter, who said, look, I've been there, I went on all these site inspections, and if he has chemical or biological weapons, their shelf life has expired. And Ritter flatly stated that he did not believe that Iraq had a nuclear weapon at that time. And those proved to be very accurate. And it was just a week ago, Phil, that Karl Rove, in his op-ed column in the Wall Street Journal, was revisiting the issue about whether Bush lied to us about weapons of mass destruction. And Rove tried to build the case once again that everybody believed
yeah,
that Iraq had these weapons, when there were millions of us who didn't believe it, and Ritter in particular was one who I talked to at the time and believed.
Well, Hans Blix, who was the head of the UN program, didn't believe he had anything either.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there were a lot of people. I was at CIA headquarters when all this was going on, and certainly at the working level at CIA, there were a lot of people, analysts and intelligence officers who were talking in the halls and the cafeteria, saying, you know, this whole argument just doesn't pass muster.
Mm-hmm. And so as we apply that experience to the present tense, is it your considered opinion and that of the sources that you've talked to at the agency and elsewhere that Amiri is essentially telling the truth and that Iran doesn't have a current weapons program of any significance?
I would have to believe that based on what I know. I think you have to be cautious. I mean, as you pointed out earlier, any country developing a nuclear weapon or a nuclear weapon capability at this point is a negative. There's no question about it. But, you know, when you put these things in context and you really look at just how threatening a situation is for the United States, I think you come to the judgment eventually that the United States should be erring on the side of caution always,
mm-hmm.
and instead of this constant belligerency, and because the belligerency itself creates a desire to have a weapon.
Yes, it does. And Phil, what about the spycraft here? In your opinion, did the agency handle Amiri in a professional and useful way?
Well, I think they, on balance, they probably did. But you know, this is—you have to realize that the agency would have been at that point, desperate to pick up a guy like this, even if he didn't have good access. And they would have, if there had been warning lights and that sort of thing going off, they probably would have chosen to ignore them. Like, for example, the fact that he defected without his family, you know, that should have been an issue. They should have been worried about it, and I think they just sort of assumed he didn't get along with his wife. In fact, I've been told that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a bad judgment. It was because partly they didn't really know the guy. This was a guy that kind of appeared. They gave him minimal training to enable him to communicate with Washington, and they took in his reports, and they kind of turned him into a superstar agent, basically to enhance what the CIA was perceived to be doing in against Iran, and so they didn't really know the guy, and this is one of the primary rules of handling an agent. There was an expression when I was doing that sort of thing, don't fall in love with your agent, because the requirement was become so intimate with this person that you knew everything about him.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly in this case, they didn't. They didn't know enough.
Yeah. And one of the curiosities is, I understand he was given about $5 million, and then when he left for Tehran, he wasn't allowed to take the money with him because of our recent sanctions.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
That's like winning the lottery and being told, but you can't collect.
Yeah, that's right. It was the whole story is kind of funny. I mean, clearly they were in the process of resettling him somewhere, and we're probably giving him a new identity, I would imagine.
Yeah, one of those Russian names that's not being used anymore?
Yeah, it could be one of those, yeah. and so anyway, he was basically like in limbo. And then, of course, when he decided he wanted to go home, whether because he felt, you know, a lot of these people, apart from the family connections and things like that, they miss their culture. I mean, think about it: if you were an American and suddenly you found yourself in Yakutsk, and you were told that you're going to be resettled there, and you'd have to get used to the local borscht and the sub-zero temperatures. I mean, you know, this is the same kind of culture shock a guy coming from Iran goes through when he winds up somewhere in the Middle West or southwestern United States, and you know, the guy might have just missed his culture, and suddenly missed it enough where it really didn't matter. He wanted to go home.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think he will find at home? Because as we've discussed, Iran is trying to play him as a double agent. For our consumption, but they're pretty brutal on people they regard as traitors.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they will make a judgment as to whether he was a genuine traitor or someone who was kidnapped. And I think they will assume that he was a genuine traitor, and they will squeeze him for whatever propaganda value there is, and then they will get rid of him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he's the loser in all this. You know, a guy who really didn't produce anything. Who really didn't hurt anybody, didn't really do anything. The U.S. is making him out to look like something of a victory because in the propaganda war. The Iranians will do the same, and this guy will wind up paying the price.
And, Phil, how do you contrast the information that you've just offered us here with the way the corporate media has played this story so far?
Well, the corporate media, basically, I think, is picking up on what the U.S. government line has been. There's been a lot of chatter, particularly in the alternative media, about how this guy might have been a double and so on and so forth, and even some speculation in the mainstream about that. But the fact is, they're basically taking the line that this was a major intelligence coup.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Well, Phil, I want to thank you for the information on this. And before we wrap up here, I referenced the Russian agents who were revealed, exposed here in the U.S. It led to this interesting spy swap. just on the heels of Medvedev's visit and Berger summit with Obama. What did you make of that episode? One of the things that intrigued me is that one of the Russians was using the name Cynthia Murphy, and that's my sister-in-law's name, so I didn't realize that my family had been infiltrated.
Well, you always have to be careful, particularly with sister-in-law.
Yeah.
my feeling was that this was a essentially a political action. There are people within the Obama administration that don't want particularly good relations with the Russians, and these people were not spies in any real sense. They were no more spies than perhaps some of these people that they arrest pizza delivery men who are labeled as terrorists because they sit around and get drunk and talk about bombing Fort Dix.
Yeah.
There are degrees and degrees of this. The Russians obviously were running a very clumsy and low-level operation, and there's no doubt that they did that. But the fact is that in previous years, this might have been handled very quietly because the relationship with Russia, between Russia and the United States, is more important than getting points on doing this kind of thing.
And don't we have a few people that fit the same profile who are in Russia collecting information, trying to figure out the politics of the moment and how people view Putin and Medvedev? And, I found it odd because I just assume that we have many of the same kinds of information collectors. Whether we call them spies or not is another issue. But we've got plenty of eyes and ears all over the world, don't we?
Well, I mean, the Russians have complained about this frequently, in fact, that the U.S. uses what we call non-government organizations to send people to Russia who are basically propagandizing and collecting that kind of information. And I think the difference is here that the Russians, clearly their intelligence service was running these particular people. In the case of the United States, these people would be allowed to do whatever they do when they're in Russia, and then when they come back home, they would be debriefed.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not actually, in a sense, run. So there's perhaps a subtle difference there. But, yeah, you're absolutely right that everyone collects this kind of information. Everyone wants to know what's going to happen in countries that are big enough or powerful enough to have an impact on your own country.
And when we pull a thread like we did off a rug like this, don't other parts of the fabric start to unravel? And shouldn't we expect that pretty soon some of our operatives are going to be exposed in Russia?
Absolutely. It's a truism that when you push a button somewhere, a button pops out somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And nowhere more true than in intelligence operations.
And who were these four guys that we took in exchange? I'd never heard of any of them.
Yeah, I'd never heard of any of them either.
That's scary. You're supposed to know.
Yeah. I don't know anyone that seems to know anything about them.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, Philip Giraldi, a pleasure to talk with you again. And people can read your work at antiwar.com and also at the website of the American Conservative. Phil, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bonjour, this is Véronique Raskin. I am the CEO of the Organic Wine Company, and I want to personally invite you to join the Peter B. Monthly Organic Wine Club. Call me for the details, and I do answer my phone, at 1-888-ECO-WINE, or visit us at www.theorganicwinecompany.com. A bientôt, j'espère. Merci.
Hear ye! The court's in session. The court's in session. Now, here come the judge. Here come the judge.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, here comes the judge. Superior Court Judge Richard E. Tuttle, retired from the California court system.
Stop beating that fudge. Court's here come the judge.
And Judge Tuttle is breaking ranks with his other robed colleagues, retired or active, in offering some very interesting commentary about a sitting justice of the United States Supreme Court, Anthony Kennedy. And in doing so, he took out a full-page ad that I found in my San Francisco Chronicle today. And there's a backstory here because he ran it in the Chronicle after the Sacramento Bee refused to take his money and run this full-page ad. Judge Tuttle, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Peter.
It's nice to talk with you, and I know you're up on McKellamy Hill. I've been there once, up in the foothills of the Gold Country, It's a really special part of California.
Thank you.
So tell me about yourself a little bit. I know you're a retired judge, but I don't know how long you served, and I don't know what motivated you to spend almost $40,000 of your own money to make a pretty powerful statement about Justice Kennedy.
Okay. Peter, I may be wrong, but I get the impression that maybe you're so far left of center that I might appear like someone from the right. with your permission, I'd like to describe my place on the political spectrum for a minute or two.
Well, you go right ahead.
I do come from a long line of Republicans. My great-grandfather, who crossed the plains by wagon in 1849, came from Genesee County in upstate New York.
Mm-hmm.
He attended Hobart College and became a lawyer. In California, he was elected as a state senator as an anti-slavery Democrat. But in 1856, he left the Democratic Party to become a Republican, and he presided over the state convention, which named John C. Fremont as a Republican candidate for president that year.
Mm-hmm.
And then later in 1860, if you wanted to vote for Abe Lincoln, why, you voted for Charles A. Tuttle, because he was one of the four presidential electors on the ballot.
Interesting.
The family remained Republican. They were great admirers of Teddy Roosevelt. And back in 1912, my mother bull moosed with Teddy.
Wow.
My father remained loyal to President Taft because he'd been a Yale classmate of my father's. But later, the family supported Harding, Coolidge, Hoover, Landon, Tom Dewey, and so on. But I should point out that in 1936, the youngest son at 15 kind of began to think for himself, and so he defected to FDR in 1936. That was me. But back in those years, in California, Earl Warren was our hero, along with State Senator Tom Kuchel, State Controller Bob Kirkwood. My older brother was an Auburn attorney. He was a state inheritance tax appraiser, which was a patronage job in those years under Bob Kirkwood. My brother was also a strong Nelson Rockefeller man.
Mm-hmm.
But then, sadly, these sound and reasonable Republicans were ousted by a gang of far-right extremists led by Max Rafferty. Max Rafferty defeated Tom Kuchel in the primary. But then he was defeated by Alan Cranston in the runoff.
Mm-hmm.
Rafferty and his buddies thought that our own government was our bitter enemy, and that taxes are a burden inflicted by greedy bureaucrats upon innocent citizens. Now, these folks seem to me to ignore what our government actually does. It provides police and fire protection for public safety, provides education for our children. It maintains hospitals and public health facilities. It takes care of the disabled and provides for the old and those who cannot care for themselves.
Now, Judge Tuttle, if you keep going like this, every member of the California Tea Party, all four of them, will be coming to your front door.
Well, no, I just kind of wonder what happened the sane Republicans, because there used to be a lot of them.
Well, let me mention one, and I'm a little younger than you are, but Pete McCloskey is a man that I've known for many years, have a lot of respect for, and about 2 years ago he said, I'm becoming a Democrat because my party has left me.
Well, that's a perfectly reasonable position, I suppose. I don't have that difficulty because I've been a Democrat since 1936.
Mm-hmm.
But the trouble is, the Republican Party doesn't show any signs of recovering from this, their absurd delusion that you can live in a decent society without paying for it.
Right.
You know, it's not without reason that taxes are described as the price of civilization.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have a decent country without paying for it. But at any rate, that's where I land up politically. It's pretty conservative, actually. I personally fear mob rule, and if I'd been in Paris in 1789, I'd have tried to get a committee together to intercede as the mob approached the Bastille, saying, hey, can't we kind of talk this over and come to a compromise? I have a profound belief that bad as things may seem, they can always get a hell of a lot worse. I feel that radical and ill-considered change is more likely to make things worse than better. And there was a time when this was considered a conservative position. You support your government. It's your friend, not your enemy.
Right.
You avoid sudden and abrupt change, and you make sure all your citizens enjoy full constitutional rights.
And Judge Tuttle, how long did you serve on the bench?
Well, I served counting the period of 20 years. I served after retirement, working half-time as a judge in the mountain counties. There I served 25 years altogether. I retired early, but I wanted to work up here in the mountains where I'd been raised.
I see. Mm-hmm. So tell me about your history and how it links to Anthony Kennedy and the Kennedy family, because in this full-page ad that you took out, you offered information that I never knew about the background of Justice Anthony Kennedy.
Well, I've stated what my background and my relationship to the lobbying business was, and when I first finished law school, I was a lobbyist in Sacramento, and his dad was one of the two or three big figures in lobbying in Sacramento.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any dispute about that.
And Anthony Kennedy, the younger, also, he actually took over his father's firm.
Well, his dad died in 1963, and he'd been out of law school a couple of years working in San Francisco, and he came up to take over the practice. Let me make one thing clear, though, Peter. It's not significant to me whether 40% or 30% or whatever percent of his practice involved actually lobbying at the legislature, is that he has the mindset, the belief, the conviction that people with wealth are entitled without restriction to spend their wealth to influence the government. Now, that mindset is what is critical, and that is what was reflected in the Citizens United case.
Well, indeed. And you wrote in your piece here, Justice Kennedy is directly responsible for the two worst decisions of the last 50 years, Citizens United, which you just referenced, that's January of 2010, and Bush v. Gore in January of 2001.
Correct. I don't think there are people who would dispute it, but I think if you were to poll the top constitutional law people at the leading universities, they would rank those decisions as there was the Korematsu case, which upheld concentration camps for American citizens who happened to be of Japanese ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
They're really deplorable decisions.
And, Judge Tuttle, one of the issues that came out of an important case in California, it was Santa Clara versus the Southern Pacific Railroad, laid the groundwork for what is referred to as corporate personhood. And this is one of the fundamentals that was at play in the Citizens United case. And it once again reflects on the mindset of the swing vote on the Supreme Court, Justice Kennedy. Talk a little bit about your view of the Santa Clara versus Southern Pacific and how you think it was viewed by Justice Kennedy.
I can't comment on that because I've not read it recently, and I would just be giving you a broad sell, a bunch of baloney, if I tried to say anything intelligible about it.
Okay, but you could talk about the broader point of...
The important thing to me is what the four justices in dissent said.
Okay.
And that, I think, is the correct view, and it's laid out by Justice Stevens and the other judges very well.
And go ahead and summarize that for us, if you would.
I can't. I don't have it before me.
Okay. Okay. But basically, they took the position that corporations don't enjoy the same rights as persons, and this is a fundamental divide that could cascade further into heightening the rights enjoyed by corporations and reducing the role of individual persons.
Yes. I think when you cross that divide and you say, these corporations, with no soul, no reason to exist other than to make money, are enjoyed to the same political rights as human beings like you and me. Now, that's a travesty, and that's why the American people, as shown in that poll that I appended to my ad, 80%, 8 out of 10 of the Americans don't like what Kennedy ruled in that case. They don't want to see the money bags take over the country.
Now, we had a case here in California in our primary election in June, and I've talked about it on this program. Many of my listeners are familiar with Proposition 16, which was a piece of special interest initiative sponsored, bought, and paid for, and, you know, the television was flooded with ads from our electric utility, Pacific Gas and Electric. And fortunately, 52-point-something percent of the electorate rejected this corporate power grab. But it was a breathtaking effort because PG&E wanted to pass a measure by a simple majority that would impose a requirement of a supermajority for any local modifications. And it had to do with the creation of new public utilities at the county or local level. And PG&E wanted to block this on a statewide level by requiring a supermajority vote in the future. And this, to me, was stunningly undemocratic and nakedly a corporate power grab.
I think you've summed it up very well. You can look at it in one sense as encouraging. It was defeated despite the millions that PG&E poured into this. On the other hand, it's discouraging that they got damn near 48% of the people to believe that hogwash just by spending dollars.
Well,
That's scary.
You're certainly right about that. Now, Judge Tuttle, one of the issues that I think is really important, what you have raised here, and let me quote this one paragraph. "I am sick enough to puke," you wrote, "when I see Kennedy, feted by various law schools, including my own, as the ideal, well-balanced, and fair-minded justice. He is, after all, the man responsible for the two worst decisions of the last 50 years. And you go on to talk about the Stanford Law School and the way they have kissed up to the Chief Justice, Roberts, and how in order to preserve relationships, bragging rights, and maybe the opportunities for law students to clerk for justices of the court, that they play nice.
I'm not picking on Stanford. Yale and Harvard and Columbia and University of Chicago are equal offenders. Stanford does not stand out amongst this group. It is just all the leading law schools succumb to this temptation. I'm not picking on Stanford.
Oh, okay, that's fine. But you do go into some detail about Dean Sullivan there, and I understand your point, because I think that law school deans should be setting an example for students, not to be disrespectful, but also not to be toadies who accept partisan politics when it's pushed through as a Supreme Court decision. And we're being way too polite about these things, particularly in the legal community.
Well, I think it's just, you can argue that you have to maintain decent relationships, but in the long run it will lead to moderation. I think that's ridiculous, as I've indicated in my article. But at any rate, there comes a point when it's incumbent to stand up and say what's true. Be candid. And I think sometimes the academic community has not done well by this. Right after Bush against Gore, there was a full-page ad in the New York Times, paid for by hundreds of academics, but they were all graduate students, lecturers. None of the leading constitutional lawyers at Harvard or Stanford or Yale put their names to this. It was highly critical of the Supreme Court. It subscribed to Justice Stevens' dissent that this was an abhorrent decision. But the sad thing was that there were no leading academic figures. There were hundreds of academic figures at lower levels who paid for this ad. But the big shots stood back because they wanted to maintain their cordial relationship with the Republican powerhouses that were running the court. And that's kind of sad.
Yeah, it certainly is.
I did want to add one thing.
Go ahead.
If you allow me enough time. I wanted to run briefly through the sequence of events between me and the Sacramento Bee, because I feel they're going to respond, and I'd like to get on the record exactly what happened.
Okay, great. Yeah, and just for the record, the ad, the full-page ad that I'm referring to, was published in the San Francisco Chronicle on July 21st, and at the top is a discussion by Judge Tuttle of the rejection of this very same ad by the leading newspaper in our state capital, the Sacramento Bee. Tell us about that.
Okay, well, in the first part of July, I wrote a letter to the editor of the Bee, Melanie Sills, who's the editor of the Bee, and I have before me a copy of that letter. And I thought this was a significant matter, that is, Justice Kennedy's role in the in these cases.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to bring it to the personal attention of the editor of the Bee, and I sent it by certified mail to ensure that she saw it personally. And let me just quote one paragraph from that letter, which was a couple of pages long.
Go ahead.
This is my quotation. Kennedy's opinion, that is, in the Citizens United case, Kennedy's opinion ranks as the worst decision since Dred Scott. Its capacity for evil exceeding that of Korematsu against U.S., which upheld in a time of national hysteria the validity of concentration camps for American citizens. The ongoing threat of Citizens United is greater, since it moves us toward a form of corporate fascism, with details legally approved by misguided voters drowning a sea of millions of corporate dollars as unrestricted business advertising floods the country. That was part of my letter to Melanie Sills, editor of the Bee. I got no reply to that letter. And getting no reply, I later just applied to the advertising department of the Bee.
Mm-hmm.
And I dealt with a young lady there, Sue Price, who was most helpful. And I indicated that the $25,000 price was agreeable to me. And my discussions with Miss Price culminated in two key emails with just about three sentences, which I would like to read for the record.
Please do.
The first one is dated July 12. And this is directed to me from Sue Price. And it says, I wanted to let you know that I received your copy. I have sent it forward to management, which I am sure they will send to our attorneys to approve whether we can run it or not. I will try to get an answer back no later than tomorrow. Take care, comma, Sue. That was on July 12th.
Mm-hmm.
On July 13th, I received this letter from Sue Price. Richard, the Sacramento Bee has declined to publish your advertising. Please feel free to ask again when you have something else you might want to publish. Sue, no explanation whatsoever. And that's what kind of put me over the edge where I'm willing to spend some money to embarrass the Bee, because I think they should be embarrassed.
Well, it is amazing, because when you look at all the kinds of advertising, including political advertising, that they accept, what you have offered here is in no way libelous, scurrilous, or frivolous.
Well, San Francisco Chronicle lawyers had no problem at all. I might say they made a couple of suggestions that tightened it up and made it better, but perhaps I shouldn't say that out loud.
Well,
they didn't find it libelous. That, you know, there's nothing
Editing suggestions are far different from a rejection of the entire piece.
True.
So I hope that you do embarrass the Bee under its latest management, the Media News Group, and that they will see the error of their ways, because I think that, you know, they allow people to go on their website and publish all kinds of commentary, including things that involve scatological remarks and personal attacks.
Yeah.
And so to exclude you, again, without explanation and without any guidance, where they said, well, if you took out the part about this,
yeah,
our lawyers would approve it.
Right.
And so they're treating you like a crank, and I think you've established quite well to our listeners here that you're far from that.
Well, I did have to do a bit of self-advertising to show that I'm not a flake.
Mm-hmm.
But I think my record shows I'm not a flake.
Yeah. So do you seek further circulation for this? You're going to put it in the L.A. Times or the New York Times, or are you tapped out?
You know, if I had a pocketbook like Sean Penn's, I'd put it in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and the L.A. Times. But my pocketbook, the old assets took a big dent on this one, and I think we'll kind of hunker down and let somebody else carry the banner from now on.
And just to be fair to our listeners, you spent $38,700 to pay for this ad in the San Francisco Chronicle.
That was community property, and I did not have an enthusiastic spouse.
Well, Judge Tuttle, it's a real pleasure to talk with you. Let me just ask you one more thing. What is your take on Elena Kagan, President Obama's latest nominee for the court, to replace Justice Stevens?
No personal knowledge at all, but anybody who has her record is the dean who kind of salvaged Harvard Law School, which was in dire straits when she took over, and her record as Solicitor General. It's hard to work up a feeling that this woman is unqualified to be a Supreme Court justice. I think she'd be first rate.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we will certainly be watching and waiting. She has cleared the Judiciary Committee, but the Republicans are delaying the final vote on her confirmation. Judge Tuttle, thank you again for being a great citizen and for sharing the information that you think people should know about Justice Kennedy.
Thank you, Peter. I've enjoyed it.
Nice to talk with you. That's retired Judge Richard Tuttle, talking to us from McKelamy Hill, California. Thanks for listening to this episode. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.